So I think this is a very good topic because, personally, I think it's a very good topic because I'm very rarely on time for things. So if you're a Buddhist monk, then it's okay. You can tell people if you're late and that, you can tell people just to stop being attached to being on time. And instead of being angry at you for being late, they're like, "Oh, sadhu, sadhu, wonderful teaching." So some of the benefits of being a monk. Anyway, so the teaching of timelessness, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. So how I like to do things when I do the talks, usually I like to give a bit of an introduction to meditation to start with, and then we can do some meditation together for maybe just 20 minutes or something. And then afterwards we can go into a bit more of a Dhamma talk. I like to break it up a bit because sometimes it's a bit hard to concentrate because my talks are like usually really boring. So after a little while everyone falls asleep. So okay. So timelessness. So what I'd like to do is to look at that concept of timelessness from a point of view of meditation to start with. And we can do some practice because, of course, you know, the Buddha wasn't really he was obviously a great philosopher, but he wasn't really interested in philosophy for the sake of it. So he wasn't really interested in the philosophical questions around time and so on and so forth so much, but he was more interested in the practical things. Yeah. So we see the word timeless is included in the basic chant of the recollection of the Dhamma, right? So when you chant akaliko, it literally means timeless. Now, the word akalika in Pali, if you interpret it, out of any context, it's somewhat vague. Like a bit like the English word timeless is a bit vague, right? But actually, it has quite a specific meaning in its context, which we'll come to a bit later on. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, what's time? Well, from a Buddhist point of view, time is a concept. Time is not something which exists absolutely. It's a concept, and as a concept, it exists relative to our mind, to our consciousness. Okay, so there's no such idea as objective time in Buddhism. Actually, this is something which is still debated very much in modern science and so on. There's really no clear idea of what time is. And it's actually one of the mysteries in physics, which physicists still really disagree about, is why time actually has an arrow. Because if you look at most of the equations of physics and so on, you can all turn them backwards, right? They will run backwards and forwards. Yeah? So you should be able to run the universe backwards and forwards. But the universe doesn't run backwards and forwards. It only runs forwards. And so this is actually one of that arrow they call entropy, is one of the things which is a very big philosophical problem in modern physics. So from a Buddhist point of view, we don't worry so much about the objective time and what's measured by a clock, but we're looking at time as a subjective experience. And time as a subjective experience essentially is the changes in consciousness. Okay? And those changes in consciousness aren't the same thing as what's measured in a clock. And you all know that, right? If you've done some meditation, right, you know how what's going on in your mind doesn't match up with what's going on in the clock. Yeah, you sit there and meditate. Oh my God, it must be half an hour already. And you sneak a quick peek at the clock. Oh, it's only 2 minutes. what's going on there, right? Huh? And then sometimes the opposite. Sometimes you sit there and say, "Oh, that's so peaceful. It feels nice." And you look. It feels like, you know, half an hour's gone past. Actually, maybe it's 2 hours or something like that. Same thing if you're on retreat. If you've ever done a meditation retreat, oh, it's strange. Your time shifts. What happens on meditation retreats, the more you meditate, the minutes get longer and longer and the days get shorter and shorter. Is that right? Yeah? You feel every minute so intensely when you're meditating, and yet the days, they just go by like that, and you go, "Oh, what happened? The retreat's already over." So this is a shifting in your perception of time, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, this is because time isn't an objective thing. It's not constant like the ticking of a clock. It's something which is just a changing in your awareness. So when we're coming to meditate in a few minutes, we're just going to do a mindfulness meditation. And in that mindfulness meditation, we're going to look at change. Okay? So it's a basic teaching of the Buddhism on impermanence. Right? Everything changes. Right? As soon as you close your eyes to meditate, right? The first thing everybody says, you ask people, how's your meditation? Right? The first thing they say, oh, I was thinking so much. Right? And people think that's a problem. Right? You think it's a problem to think. Right? We're weird. Buddhists are very, very strange people. Okay? I mean, have you ever thought about how strange Buddhists are? First thing we do is, like, if we want, our idea of a good time is to sit in a room together and not say anything to each other. It's so weird. Right? And we also think that thinking is a problem. Isn't that strange? Yeah? Like, you go to all the university, you can talk to all the psychologists and people there, none of them think that thinking is a problem. Thinking is what you do. You have to think good, you have to think well, you're trained to think better. But when you sit down to meditate, well, he's thinking. Of course, what's the thinking? Thinking is change, right? It's all going over and over and over against this kind of grinding of this wheel of time. One of the things that's really struck me, you know, when it comes to me more and more vividly, when I in the last year or two, and I've been listening to people talk about their meditation in interviews and retreats and so on, And there seems to be this way that we have of thinking about meditation, which the more I look at it, the more strange it appears to me, and the more it appears to me quite different from how the Buddha talked about meditation. And what I mean is this, that when we talk about meditation, we always have this idea, something like this, that I'm in here, I'm trying to pay attention to my meditation, right? So I'm trying to watch the breath or whatever it is I'm doing in meditation. But it's like, I'm in here, the breath is out there. And then people say, oh, there's all these thoughts coming in, right? That's how you feel, right? You feel like these thoughts coming in. So that's already three things, isn't it? Yeah? There's you in here, somehow, what you think is you, and then there's the breath, which is something separate out there, and then there's the thoughts. But of course, they're not separate at all. It's all just you, right? So why do we see these as being separate things? And once you do that, then of course you think, oh, it's really hard to stop thinking. How do I keep the thoughts out? Right? And then, it's really hard to pay attention to the breath. It's hard to keep my mindfulness there. Yeah? Because it's something separate from you. And so the more that I look at it, the more I practice, the more it seems to me this is a very unhelpful way of thinking about meditation. I'm not quite sure why that's become so pervasive, you know? And after I started to notice it, I could see it everywhere, you know? When I came to Perth one time last year, I arrived in the airport and I got a taxi from the airport and chatting with the taxi driver. Oh, yeah, and he does some meditation. So that's good. And I said, how is meditation? He said, oh, well, I'm sitting there, I'm trying to watch my breath and I'm trying to concentrate, and then all of these thoughts keep coming in and I don't know how to get rid of the thoughts. Even the taxi drivers have the same thing. So what's actually going on? Actually, that you, that what you feel is in here, that's just part of who you are. The breath, right, is also part of who you are. The thoughts are also part of who you are. Of course, when I say who you are, right, from a Buddhist point of view, we don't really mean, you know, there's no you there in the first place. What we really mean is it's part of what you're doing. Yeah? This is the important thing. Thoughts are not something that happened to you. Yeah? Thoughts are something that you do. Thoughts are a behavior. Right? That's a much better way of looking at it. Thoughts are a behavior. It's how your mind behaves. Yeah? Once we start looking at it like that, we begin to have a chance of being able to deal with them in a more useful and constructive way. Thoughts aren't something that happen to us. We're not the passive victim of thoughts. Thoughts are something that we are doing. And if we're doing it, we can stop doing it. Yeah? So when we look at this approach, this way of approaching meditation, when you are creating those thoughts, when you are moving your mind, you're changing your consciousness, you are creating time. Okay? Time is something that only exists when there is change. Right? We know the night and the day because they're different. We know the summer and the winter. Well, of course, in Singapore, you don't know the summer and the winter, so I don't know how you know what time of year it is. But I guess there's like a monsoon and stuff. But anyway, so things change. Yeah? That's how we know time. What happens in your mind when it's not changing anymore? Okay? When the thoughts become peaceful, yeah, mind is empty and quiet. Of course, there's still change going on, but it's much more subtle. When that very subtle change is going on, mind is peaceful. Your perception of time starts to shift. Yeah? So you're going into a timeless realm. So anyway, that's enough talking for now. Let's do some meditation together. And what I'd like to do for this, we'll do a guided meditation, and we'll just do a straight mindfulness practice. So for tomorrow, anybody who's coming for the meditation workshop tomorrow, I'll be doing loving kindness meditation. But for this evening, we'll just do mindfulness. So sitting quietly, letting the mind settle back inside the body. Noticing the feelings, the sensations, just in the different parts of the body. Moving the mind around the body, noticing any pressure, the feeling of the seat, the touch of the cloth on the skin, any tensions or energies inside the body. Just notice those. Don't get caught up in them, don't get obsessed by them, just notice them. Oh, okay, that's how that is. All right. Let the mind settle back in stillness and peace. When your mind starts to think about things, so just bring awareness to that, gently with compassion and kindness. Just, oh, okay, it's my mind thinking. All right. Don't try to push it away. Don't try to analyze it or follow it or anything. Just be aware of it. Oh, okay. Notice how it feels. Notice how when you start to think, there's always some kind of energy associated with it, some tension, some vibration. So just know that, be aware, bring compassion. Pay close attention to the silence, to the space, to the gap in between the thoughts. Whenever mind goes wandering off, doing this and that, don't see that as something that's a problem or something that's other or something that's alien to you. Just recognize that's what you're doing in that moment. Memories are not something that happened to you. Memories are what you do. Feelings are what you do. Thoughts are what you do. So just bring awareness to those, bring attention, bring care, bring kindness, and let them go. to enjoy the quiet. It's so nice to be nothing there. To lay down the burden of thinking. To lay down the burden of remembering. Just to know. Just to be peaceful. coming near the end of the meditation. Before we finish, taking a minute to reflect back, asking, what just happened? How did my mind change? What was going on during that meditation? Does my mind feel different now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can share the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. And I wanted to say just two special messages, one big one and one small one for this evening. Well, not that small, but anyway, a big one. I wanted to just share merit and to share metta for the people of the Philippines who, as you all know, have been suffering so very greatly this past week. And so I want a special thought of loving kindness for all those people, and I'm sure that you're all doing what you can to try to help. And I also wanted to mention Tilly, who is the dog of some very good friends of mine in Sydney who passed away just an hour or two ago. So I wanted to share merits with Tilly so that Tilly can get reborn in the human realm next time. Okay, and then we can come out of meditation. No need to turn the lights on, please, please. Thank you. All right, so listen, please come in if you need to come in. Oh, thank you very much. Okay, so for that meditation, we had some, reflect back on that experience and the experience of meditation. There's some things, right? There's some thoughts and some feelings and sensations and all of that stuff. And there's also some absences. There's a lack of thought, a lack of sensation, right? There's spaces between things. One of the characteristics of the human mind and the way that we train our mind, the way we use our perception, is that we always notice things. We don't notice gaps. So if you walk into this room, you'd think, wow, there's so many people, right? Oh, this room's crowded. I don't know. I haven't got anywhere to sit. Right? But actually, if you just go a little bit higher, there's just space. Right? There's more space in this room than there is people. Right? You could walk into this room and think, my goodness, it's so empty. There's so much space in this room. And that's just even at an obvious level. You know, if you look in the level of physics, then we know that even our bodies, there's just energies whirling in space. You know what they call atoms and matter and so on? It's almost all space. Just tiny little flecks of energy in this huge space. And yet we think it's crowded. That's our perception. Yeah? That shapes how we see things. So this is one of the ways, because, you know, I've lived for many years in forest monasteries, and when you live in the forest monastery, then, you know, you always come from time to time down to the city and so on. And, you know, a lot of people say, how do you do that? Yeah? Because, I don't know, if you've been on retreat and then you're very quiet for a period of time, and then you come back and everything's really hard to cope with, right? You've been rendered completely dysfunctional by being on the retreat. When we finish a retreat, I always tell people to I don't know whether to say be mindful or not be mindful when you're driving home. Because they get into, you get into this very kind of slow mindfulness when you're on retreat. And you should be mindful when you're driving home, but not that kind of mindfulness, right? You need sharp mindfulness when you're on the road. So, space. Yeah? You can walk down any street and you think, oh, so many people, it's so crowded, so many things. But just look a little bit higher and there's just space. Even between the people is space. And that's what gives everything meaning, right? That's what makes it possible to function. Imagine if you took all of the space out of this room. Terrible. Everyone just piled up in one big heap on top of one another. You couldn't even live, right? A couple of minutes and we'd be all suffocating. Without space, we'd be dying. Yeah? And so the same thing that applies to space also applies to time. You know, we think that everything's very hectic. We have this perception that, oh, life's going very fast. Yeah? But this is all relative. Yeah? I remember one comment that's made by a Buddhist scholar, or an Indological scholar, Max Müller. He said that it's not with today's fast pace of life, rapid transport and rapid communications, it's not possible, or it's very difficult or impossible to realize the same peace of mind that was realized by the great sages in India in the past. Yeah? Is that true? Is life just too fast? Because that statement was spoken in the 1880s. Okay? In the 1880s, life was much too fast. You know, you could send... you could post a letter and it would be delivered in like a week. That's amazing. You could get in a horse and carriage and just be at your destination in no more than a few hours. Fast-paced life in Victorian England and Europe. It's all relative. Yeah? It's all relative. So in truth, the life itself is neither fast nor slow, but it's our perception. So if we come to this idea of timelessness, what the Buddha talked about timelessness, you know, timeless, I always had this idea that we should have a Buddhist magazine called Timeless, right? Instead of Time Magazine, right? It would be good, wouldn't it? Timeless Magazine. Okay, so that's the idea. You can take that up and run with it. I won't exert any copyright over that. You can just take that idea and make the magazine. Okay, timelessness. Okay, we akalika in Pali. We say akalika. Now, what does akalika mean? Now, actually, if you look at different people's perspectives on it, different people will explain that in different ways. And sometimes people say that akalika means timeless in a philosophical sense. So akalika means that the Dhamma doesn't have anything to do with time. Okay? But that's a little bit of a weird explanation, because actually if you look at some of the things in the Dhamma, you see that it obviously does have something to do with time. For example, the Buddha was recollecting his past lives. Right? Well, that's happening in the past. That's time. So, I'm not sure whether that's a correct explanation. Some others explain akalika or timelessness in a sense, a bit like what I was suggesting earlier of timelessness being a state of the mind where time isn't operating. But if you look at the way that the word timeless is used in the suttas, it actually has a slightly different meaning. Now in the recollection of the Dhamma that we recite, yeah, akaliko, sandhittiko, akaliko, these two words, sandhittika and akalika, actually these often occur together in the Pali, and they basically have the same meaning. And what they basically mean is in this very life. That's what timeless means. Yeah? And there's quite a few places in the suttas that this meaning is brought forward. So a typical kind of example was one time where somebody came to the Buddha and criticized the Buddha and his teaching because he said that you are neglecting, right? Neglecting the pleasures of this life for the sake of the pleasures of the future life. Okay? So the criticism, of course, is to say that, you know, we can enjoy ourselves here and now, right? We can have good food and all of these kinds of things and enjoy all these pleasures of life. But, you know, you monks are off there just meditating and stuff. So you must be doing that because you want to have a pleasant life afterwards. Okay? So this is a very kind of conventional religious way of thinking about it, isn't it? You deny yourself in the present in order that you can experience pleasure in the future, i.e. by going to heaven or something like that. Yeah, and Karl Marx kind of satirized that. He said it's a pie in the sky when you die. Have you heard of that one before? A pie in the sky when you die. That's what Karl Marx criticized the Christian church. He said that's what they offer you. Yeah, you don't get anything now, but after your death you get it. So this is that criticism, right? And the words that's used is to say that what's pertaining to the future life is called samparayika, right? Pertaining to the future life, and you're neglecting what is sandhyatika or what is akalika. In other words, you're neglecting what pertains to this life for the sake of what happens in the next. That's how the Buddha was being criticized. And the Buddha responded to that criticism by saying exactly the opposite is true, yeah? That what you're doing, right, is what is kalika or samparayika. So what your actions are creating karma that will reap results in the future. Yeah? But what we're doing is we're focusing on what is akalika or what is sandhittika, which is what you can realize in this very life. Yeah? So the purpose of the Dhamma is not for what is samparayika, but what is for akalika or sandhittika. In other words, we don't live the Dhamma in order to get reborn in heaven, although that's all right if you get reborn in heaven. It's better than the alternative, usually. But we practice it in order to realize it in this very life. That's the point. This is what the Buddha is pointing at again and again and again. The Dhamma is something that you practice in order to realize it in this very life. Okay? That is what everyone here, I hope, everyone here already did in our meditation we just did together. Now you might be thinking, not me, my meditation was rubbish. It's amazing how many people, if you're on retreats, think that everybody else is so peaceful. Ah, they're going, oh, all these things and feelings, emotions, everything's going on. Ah, all these other people are sitting, they look so peaceful. So, but number one, okay, first thing, you know it, right? If your mind's not peaceful, at least you know that your mind's not peaceful. You know that you're restless. You know that you're thinking all over the place. You know your mind is completely mad and out of control. Okay? So that's pretty bad, but it's better than not knowing it, right? Which is what we normally do, right? Normally our minds are all like that, and we think that's normal, right? That's the normal state, and that's how most people die like that, right? Most people are born, get old, and they die, and that's how their minds are, and they don't even know any better. They don't even know it. They don't know that there's a possibility of doing something about it. Yeah? I remember once when we were in the monastery in Thailand, and some of these European tourists, this young couple came to the monastery, and they were talking to them, and they asked this kind of question. You know, they'd heard a bit about meditation and stuff, and they asked this question. Do you think, you monks doing here, do you think that it's possible to actually stop thinking? Right? It's not at all obvious. Yeah? Most people, your minds are thinking all the time. and the possibility that you can stop thinking. I remember I thought of that once when I was a kid. I must have been about, I don't know, 14 or something like that, 14 or 15. And I thought to myself, I wonder if it's possible to stop thinking. So I said, okay, let's do it. No, it's not possible. So your mind's going, thinking all the time. But, of course, it's not thinking all the time. And your mind is actually stopping thinking all the time. Ah, this is the secret to meditation. Not trying to, if people, how do I make myself stop thinking? You already stop thinking all the time. Okay? Every thought that you have ends. This is just impermanence. Right? That's just impermanence. You can't just keep thinking all the time, right? You can't just keep on going thinking. Every thought you have has an energy to it. It's conditioned, right? It's conditioned. And like any conditioned phenomenon, it's limited and it has its end. It comes up, it stays for a while, and then it ends. Every thought you've ever had in your life is like that. Every thought that you've ever had has ended. You think about that, right? You might have a thought in your mind right now, but that's only one. There's millions of them that you don't have. They've all ended. Yeah? So your mind might not be completely quiet now, but it doesn't have the noise of those million thoughts. They've all ended because they're all impermanent. You don't have to do anything to stop thinking. Your mind stops thinking all the time. Yeah? That's the secret to meditation. It's a bit like giving up cigarettes. I was never a smoker, but this is kind of a joke about giving up cigarettes. People say, oh yeah, giving up cigarettes is really easy. I've done it dozens of times. So giving up is easy, right? What's hard? Not starting again. That's what's hard, not starting again. Yeah. So it's the same thing with thought. Stopping thinking is easy. You do it all the time. But what happens is, because we don't think that we think that thinking is valuable. So we pay attention to that. We don't think that stopping thinking or that the ending of thoughts is valuable. We don't think that the silence is valuable. We don't think that the space is valuable. So we don't pay any attention to that. Right? But without the space, and without the gaps, the time that will give your thought space to breathe, without that, your mind couldn't operate. In exactly the same way that if there wasn't space in this room, right, we would all die. Yeah? Simple as that. Same thing when there's no space in your mind, right? That's what they call like a psychosis or something like that, right? That's what actually happens when you really can't stop thinking. Your mind's absolutely fired up. Your brain's so fired up, it just goes and goes and goes without any control or any relief, right? It's a severe form of madness or psychosis. And you can't sustain that, right? You either break down or something. Normally, there is space in the mind already. And the more space you have, the more meaning that your thoughts will have. Yeah? And the more space you have, the more meaning that the thoughts will have. Again, you can think about that in an analogy with physical space as well. I mean, just imagine that if you had, say, the word peace, right? And so imagine that you wrote the word peace on the page, and you just have a page, and you wrote, fill the page, right, with writing. Or you printed it out, and the word peace was there in the middle among a whole bunch of other things. You'd hardly notice it. On the other hand, if you had that word, the same page, and just the word peace in the middle of the page with nothing else on there, it becomes very powerful. So one of the things that the silence and that the time in meditation gives you is it gives a depth to your thoughts. quality to them. So I think the quality of thoughts is not about how many thoughts you have. It's about the space you have around them. The more space, the deeper that your thoughts will be. And this is something which is becoming increasingly recognized, not just in Buddhism, but also in a lot of corporate environments and so on as well. And I read a few months ago that at the Google headquarters in California, they not only teach meditation there regularly. Thich Nhat Hanh's been there to teach meditation, various other teachers. They have meditation rooms and things like that. But they even just finished building a walking meditation hall. Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. So you go to work in the Google, and they actually have a walking meditation hall. Why do they do that? Because they believe in Buddhism? Oh, I don't think so. Is it because they're not evil? Well, that's a bit dubious. I'm not quite sure about that. They probably do it because it makes them money. That's my guess. Why does it make them money? Because when people are working in a place like that, they're stressed, right? They've got too many things to do, too many things to think of, too much competition, too much pressure. And then they go and they sit meditation or they walk meditation, their mind becomes clear, they get a sense of perspective, and the solutions and the answers to the problems that they're struggling with come to them much more clearly. They do that because that's the most effective way of making decisions, of having insights, of developing a quality of thought and awareness. Yeah? And that means they can make more money, which is good for them. So when we meditate, we can see the benefits in this life. And you saw, whether you know it or not, you can see the benefits, even just from a short little guided meditation like we did earlier. This is why we do, why I always suggest when I do the guided meditation, we do this like a little bit of reflection at the end. Okay? So you cast your mind back over the meditation you've just done. In Pali they call this pachavekana, it's like reviewing. And this is a practice that I was taught by my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai. And I've always thought it's a very, very good practice. It has a number of benefits. One benefit it has is that it teaches you about the changes and the unfolding in your mind as the meditation proceeds. You look back and you think, oh, when we began the meditation it was like this, and then this happened it was like that, when that happened it was like that. Oh, okay, so you just trace the course of it, how it went. And when you do that again and again and again and again, you learn to recognize the patterns. Yeah, this is the thing. You know, it doesn't necessarily have any meaning when you start it. You know, it's just, oh, this happened, that happened, whatever. But over a long time, when you do it repeatedly, you can see how things unfold, and you begin to understand cause and effect. You know, you use your mind in this way and then this happens. You use your mind in that way and then that happens. And so you're gaining wisdom into the nature of the meditation practice. Another benefit that practice has, which is a bit less obvious, is that it gives your mind permission to think about the meditation. Right? Because normally what happens is while we're meditating, if something happens while you're meditating, right? Imagine you're sitting there and suddenly your mind becomes peaceful. Right? What's the very next thing that happens is you say, wow, my mind's got peaceful. Yeah? And then you're not peaceful anymore. Yeah? Yeah? So this is this kind of reaction. So by giving yourself the allowance, the permission to reflect and think about the meditation at the end of it, it means that you're not going to follow so much. You're more inclined to just not do that actually in the meditation itself. Okay? So there's a proper time and a place for thinking about the meditation, and that's at the end, not during the meditation. So even in that short meditation, and even if our meditation is not very deep, we can still experience something of that. At least we know what the thoughts are like. we know we've learned a little bit about time. For example, you know, you get restless. Yeah, you're sitting there, even though it's only a short period of time, it's 20 minutes. Sometimes you feel restless. Yeah, that restlessness is just a fighting against time, isn't it? So it's one of the benefits of meditation. You never need to be frustrated when you're waiting in a queue, or in a traffic jam, or in an elevator. It's fine. It's all right. And so notice how you have these different attitudes towards time while you're in meditation. And one of the things that you always notice on retreats is that most of the time people spend the first few days on retreats thinking about what they did before the retreat or what happened and so on. And then your mind gets peaceful and then you start to think, oh, what am I going to do after the retreat? And then there's this... And so the last few days of the retreat are usually spent thinking this kind of combination on the one hand of some excitement, well, what's going to happen when you leave, but then also not wanting it to end, but also like planning, oh, I'm definitely going to keep my meditation going after the retreat's finished, you know, and you work out all these schedules, I'm going to get up earlier, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to make sure I stop, you know, watching reality TV shows, And you have all these kind of complicated plans for how you're going to create more space in your life. And of course, then you get back home and it goes back, you do exactly the same thing you did before, usually. Maybe not. This is time, you know, we're sort of wrestling against time. But meditation is not about that. Meditation is about being aware. And so when we're being aware, just in the awareness, there's a sense of timelessness about that. Now we have this idea, and in Buddhism we often talk about the present moment. And the present moment is one of these words that I've grown to dislike more and more over the years. Actually, when we say the word present moment, the Pali version of that is pachupanakana, yeah? Present moment, literally. And that's not a word that we find the Buddha used anywhere. Right? It's not a phrase from the Buddha, from the suttas. It's not even a phrase that's used in the canonical Abhidhamma, except maybe once or twice. It's a phrase which is derived from the Visuddhimagga and the much later commentaries. So that's interesting. I wonder why that is. What's the actual difference? When the Buddha used the word pachupana, right? It just means present. Okay, he didn't use the word kana, meaning moment. Moment makes it much smaller. Okay, so present moment is something that's very small, it's very narrow. Whereas the present is not something that's very narrow. The image was given about this by the great Sri Lankan Buddhist philosopher David Kalapahana, and he said that the present moment was like walking on a tightrope, whereas the present was like riding on a camel. You can kind of wiggle around a bit and it's kind of, you know, there's a bit of kind of breadth to it, you know, you're not so likely to fall. I really like that image, yeah? So you're like kind of riding on the camel of the present rather than the tightrope of the present moment. So the present, right? We always think it's really hard to be in the present, right? Oh, my mind keeps thinking about the future and the past and so on and so forth, and how can I be in the present? Well, but you think about the present. What is a present? A present is what you get on your birthday, right? Yeah? Oh, it's so hard to get presents on my birthday. Oh, it's such a difficult thing. Oh. No, somebody just comes up and gives it to you. Yeah? That's what the present is. The present is a gift. Right? That's what the present is. You just sit there and the present is given to you. Yeah? You don't have to do anything about it. The present is a gift to you that is always there. The present is what's easy. The past and the future is hard work. Huh? You think about it, like even like animals, you know, if you've got a dog or a cat or something like that, you know how much they live in the present. My dad would always joke around with that with his dogs, right? Because my dad had a couple of, lives on a property, in rural property in Australia, and he's got a couple of dogs, and he'd always tease them, you know. He'd say he would try to, he'd always kind of train them, you know, with like giving them a bicky or something to eat or something like that, and he would try to train them to understand the word later. So you know, it's like food, and they go, oh yeah, for, later. Oh, yeah. So later is it actually a difficult concept? Now, we need, and this is what we need, language. Language is what sends our mind into the past and the future, right? That's how we can think about the past and the future, using language, right? If we don't have language, everything is present all the time, right? So this is why when the mind becomes quiet, when we're not thinking, right? Notice this connection between language and time. This is something the Buddha pointed to, actually. There's some of the suttas very explicitly talks about this. Once we get involved in language, we're getting involved in that cycle of time. He talked about this in the Mahanidana Sutta and some other places. It's a very, very profound thing, a very, very profound piece of psychology. When the mind is involved in language, it gets involved in the past and the future. And I think this is one of the great purposes behind the invention of language. Right? If you're just in the present, you don't need it. So when our mind becomes quiet, we stop using language in our mind, then there is... time disappears in that sense. So we have this sense of timelessness. And when time disappears, all of those things, all of those stresses and sufferings that go along with time also disappear. And deadlines and tensions and having to get stuff done, anxiety, stress, worry, all of those things. Think about how many of the stresses and sufferings in your life are because of time. Right? Not necessarily all of them. I mean, sometimes you just hurt, right? Someone, you get injured or something, and it doesn't involve time, it just hurts. But a lot of them involve time. You know, you're thinking about what's going to happen when you go back to work tomorrow, or what's going to happen when this happens. It's, we suffer so much. So this is why when you can put down all of those burdens, you're just aware in the present. And just that much, so much suffering has been put aside. So much suffering has been let go on. That's how easy it is to let go of suffering. No? Everyone seems to think it's letting go. Everyone seems to think these things are really hard. Letting go is really hard. Who thinks letting go is hard? Is letting go hard? Is that? Sometimes. I don't know. Letting go is easy. I can prove it to you. That's not just my opinion. That is objective fact. It's a biological truth. Letting go is easier than holding on. Look, I hold on to this thing. Yeah, you know a little bit about biology. When I learned biology at school, one of the basic facts you learn is you have two sets of muscles that work against each other, right? So you have the muscles that contract and the ones that let go. Yeah, which ones are the strong ones? Right, the holding on muscles are the strong ones. Yeah. Yes? Yes, so the muscles on the inside of your hand are stronger than the muscles on the outside of your hand. Why? Because holding on is hard work. Letting go is easy. True, isn't it? It's biology. Holding on is hard work. Letting go is easy. Yeah? Thinking is hard work. Yeah? Being quiet is easy. Being unenlightened is hard work. Being enlightened is easy. Right? Greed, hatred and delusion. is hard work. No greed, no hatred, no delusion. Ah, easy. For the monks, he says. That's ridiculous. My hand is the same as yours. Yeah? Holding on, letting go. Doesn't matter who you are or where you are. When we're monks, we've got lots of things to get attached to. My goodness. Sometimes monks get very attached to the colour of their robe. Has to be this particular shade of brown and not that shade of brown and so on. And like in Thailand, they have like a difference between the ones you have these little lines on the robe. And so one group of monks sew the lines so that the inside folds first and then the outside folds, and then the other group of monks you fold it so the outside fold first and the inside fold. True. It's true. So you can get attached to anything. Yeah. Actually, there's an interesting statement in the suttas. It says that householders tend to get attached to sensual pleasures, and ascetics or monastics tend to get attached to views. Yeah. So I think there's definitely something to that. So we all get attached to things. We all can get attached, and we can all let go. Attachment is not something that happens, you know. Attachment is something that we are actively doing all of the time. Right? This again, this idea of timelessness. When we think we have to develop this or do that, and then, you know. I had with one student when I was in Ipoh. I lived in Ipoh for a year, and one of the students there was actually a very good meditator, and she came up one time and she said, Bhante, we're talking about this idea, and we think we have this idea that we're going to get really good jobs and work really hard and earn lots of money so that we can then go away on retreat. Is that right? And she said, she obviously thought there was a bit of a contradiction there. Right? So again, it's this idea that at some time in the future you'll be able to practice. But at some time in the future it will just be present. It'll just be greed, hatred and delusion. You've got greed, hatred and delusion right now. Yeah. Actually, that's one of the stories that Ajahn Chah used to say. It was one of the insights that he had in his practice. These things can often, they're such small and obvious things, but it just depends on where you are and what you're doing. He said that one time he was staying at this monastery and he needed a new robe, and so he was sewing a new robe. In those days, of course, they didn't have sewing machines, so he'd be sewing it by hand. I'm not sure if he's making a whole new robe or just repairing one, but anyway, there he was sewing away, and he's sitting outside, and he's sitting for a while until the sun shifted, and he was sitting in the boiling hot sun and sweating while he was sewing this robe up, and he didn't even notice. He was so intent on getting the job done. And then the Ajahn happened to walk by, and he said, "You know, Cha, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm fixing this robe up." He said, "But you're why are you sitting in the midday sun?" He said, "Oh, look, I'm just really want to get it finished so I can go off and do my meditation." And so the teacher said, "But you know, your mind's full of restlessness right now. You're not present right now. Why do you want to go somewhere else so that you can let go of restlessness? Why don't you let go of restlessness right now?" And that was a very, very powerful teaching for Ajahn Chah when he was a young monk. So all of these things, greed, hatred and delusion, right? That's what we have to practice with. So that's good. That means you've all got plenty of those things. We know where we're starting from. Okay. And we shouldn't be depressed by that. We should have faith. That's what the Buddha said. He said, we all have greed, hatred and delusion. Yep, we can check that box. Yep, plenty of that. And greed, hatred and delusion leads to suffering. Yeah, and we can also check that box. Yep, that's pretty obvious. That's true. So that gives us faith. Ah, the Buddha knew what he was talking about. Yeah, and then we can begin to practice. Ah, next noble truth. Letting go of greed, hatred and delusion means we let go of suffering. Yeah, and that's something which you know, you may not have, like, you might not all be arahants yet. Okay? But you've all let go of some suffering. You've all let go of some greed at some point in your life, even if it was only once. I'm sure. Come on. It must have been once. Anger. Let go of that at least once. And that leads to a little bit of the ending of suffering. Yeah? And that's what Nibbana is. Nibbana is not anything separate from that. It's not anything more than that. It's just the perfection of it. Perfection of letting all greed, hatred and delusion go. That's what we call Nibbana. That's what awakening is. So that is that idea of timelessness. That idea that we know that this practice has results. We can see those results in the present moment. You saw those results of the practice just in that little meditation we did earlier. You don't have to have faith in me. You don't have to believe anything that I say. Okay? All that I'm talking about, I don't care whether you believe it or not. As long as you think it's worth investigating, go away and meditate and see whether it's true or not. That's the important thing. Yeah? Go away and meditate and sit and see, actually, how does the mind change? How do these things work? What happens? Maybe I'm wrong, okay? Maybe you think, no, greed, hatred and delusion is great. It makes me really happy. Fine, okay, that's fine. But so far, that's not been my experience. So we investigate and we see and let go, and you know that for yourself. You see the results for yourself in this very life. And that is really what akalika means. Okay, so I've been talking about timelessness for much too long a time, and I'd like to open up for any comments or questions.
Questions? Anyone? Oh, sure.
Thank you so much, Ajahn Sujato, for the wonderful talk. You've been talking a bit about thinking. There's a school of thought that says that we don't actually think. We are being taught, meaning that involuntary thinking is involuntary. And therefore, the only way that we can manage this thinking is to observe the thinking, watch it rather than to try and stop it. So I'm not sure whether this is exactly what you're trying to say or is it something different.
Yes, I mean, okay, so there's a few points here. One is that we can, to some extent, we can reflect on and manage and change our thinking, okay? So it's not just an either or, but sometimes you can recognize, well, if these are unwholesome thoughts, and then you can deliberately shift them to be more wholesome kinds of thoughts. And that's often a better way of doing it. Like if your mind is very, mind is thinking a lot of very unwholesome thoughts, yeah, to try to stop thinking and go to quietness of mind is sometimes too much. You're going from something that's too coarse to too quiet all at once. And actually, if you look at how the Buddha himself described that in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, he said he first describes about understanding the difference between wholesome and unwholesome thoughts, and then letting go of the unwholesome thoughts and developing wholesome thoughts. Yeah, and only then did he go and develop samadhi and develop the peace of mind that was able to let go of the thoughts altogether. So there certainly is something to be said for that approach. But even that approach doesn't necessarily mean trying to stop the thoughts, okay? Because usually awareness and understanding of the thoughts is a much more powerful technique. And there's a very lovely story about that which I really like, and this is a story from, I think it's from the Ashokavadana, one of the ancient Buddhist texts, and it's about a monk called Upagupta and how he came to go forth as a monk. He was a shopkeeper, and he used to work in his shop every day. And a monk called Shanakavasin used to walk for alms round, and Upagupta would give him some alms every day. And so eventually Upagupta decided he wanted to become a monk too, and asked Shanakavasin if he could give him the ordination. Shanakavasin said, "You're not ready yet." Yeah. said, your mind's not mature. He said, what do I do? I can't practice. I can't do meditation. I'm working in the shop all day. I have no time. Right? See, even in those days, ancient India, they still had no time. They were still working all day. Even the devas, it's interesting, in the suttas, like even the devas say to the Buddha, oh look, I really have to go now, I haven't got any time, I've got too much business to do. I mean, come on. Okay, so Shanakavasam said, okay, you do this. You get two piles of stones, one pile of like river pebbles, one pile of white pebbles, one pile of black pebbles, okay? And then when you're working in the shop, every time you have a good thought, you put a white pebble on the pile, and every time you have a bad thought, you put the black pebble on the pile. He said, can you do that? He said, yeah, I should be able to do that. He said, okay. So at the end of the first day, there's a big pile of black pebbles, one or two white ones. And then he kept on doing it, and persistently kept on doing it. And gradually the number of black pebbles goes down, the number of white pebbles increased, until there was only white pebbles. And when Shanakavasan saw that, he said, okay, now you're ready to ordain. Now, one of the interesting things about that story is that Shanakavasan wasn't telling him, stop thinking the black thoughts, right? He wasn't saying, you know, these thoughts are bad, you've got to stop it. He's just, be aware of it. Yeah, you know already. You don't have to keep telling yourself, oh, this is bad. You know what's good and bad. You know what's right and wrong. So it's a matter of recognizing it, bringing awareness to it. So I think that would make a really good app. What do you reckon? Yeah? If you've got any IT people here, then I think that would be a very good app. Yeah? Don't you reckon? Yeah? And you could do it, and you could make like graphs over time. Yeah? And you could see what's going on. And you could see, like, you know, maybe on Mondays you've got lots of black thoughts. And yeah? I think that would be quite interesting. Anyway. So that, you know, to me that's because that's right thought of the Eightfold Path, right? So that's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. So that's more preliminary development, and then from there to move on to letting go of thoughts. In terms of letting go of thoughts, also like awareness is the most powerful tool, but it's important. Awareness is fine, but sometimes what we tend to do is we want to be aware of it in order to make it go away. Right? We want to kind of dismiss the thoughts. Okay? And so one of the things I think which is helpful there is to bring a sense of compassion with it, to bring a sense of kindness to the thoughts. Actually, why are the thoughts there? Well, the thoughts are there because there's some kind of underlying tension. Right? Now, sometimes, of course, we think because we need to, right? So sometimes thoughts are good and so on. But usually, and especially when we're in meditation, we don't need to think about anything, but the thoughts come up. Why do they come up? Because there's some energy there. There's some tension. There's something driving it. And underlying that is some suffering. Okay? If you're an arahant, you don't need to think, unless there's something to think about. Right? There's nothing driving the thoughts. So there's some suffering there. So rather than getting angry with the thoughts and wanting them, oh, you're disturbing my meditation, I want to get rid of you, and pushing them away, that's just more aversion. It doesn't help. So have compassion for the thought. Oh, there's suffering there. And bring that sense of compassion to it. And then that tends to soothe the whole thing down. So rather than trying to stop the thoughts, you have compassion for them. Yeah. Another thing which is a useful way to approach it, you see, think about this example. Imagine that you're in your home, and there's some kids there, and the kids are running around and playing, okay, and they're running around and screaming and so on and so forth, and just doing the things that kids do. So what do? Sit down and shut up. So you can do that if you like. Be quiet. Well, good luck with that. I don't know if Singapore kids are like Australian kids, but I guess kids pretty much the same everywhere. So another thing that you can do, if there's a park or something like that nearby, you can say, well, you can go and play in the park. Yeah? And then or a sports field. Right? That's what sports fields are for, right? So kids can run around and make as much noise as they like, and it's okay, because they've got the space to do that. So you can think of your mind in the same way. Rather than trying to stop the thoughts, you think, well, can I make my mind bigger? Yeah? You make your mind bigger. Bringing compassion to the thoughts is one way of doing that. You're opening your arms, making your mind bigger, and in that big space, the thoughts don't really matter so much. It's okay. The thoughts come and go. They've been coming and go. You've been thinking your whole life. Yeah? It's all right. You're still here. You haven't gone mad, most of you. So, it's okay. Thoughts are all right. Don't make a problem out of them. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Bhante, you know, we've been brought up to this English proverb, right, which is procrastination is a thief of time, right?
Okay.
So we've been brought up to think that there must be some form of a pursuit, some form of an action. In your description of timelessness, it seems to very much apply into just meditation. So how can we apply this timelessness into our daily life and still be practicing or training the Noble Eightfold Path of right effort?
Procrastination is the thief of time. Yeah. A few years ago I gave a meditation in a Uniting Church service in Sydney, and they invited me to come along, and I met one of the pastor who led that service, and he invited me to come along and teach meditation. Afterwards, he said, you know, that was the most peaceful that this church has ever been. One of the things I noticed, because, you know, they had like this service, and they gave like a schedule for the service, and, you know, like it starts at 10, at 9 o'clock, and then at 9:10 they sing such and such a hymn, and at 9:15 they do such and such, and at 9:20. And they actually did those things at that time. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. I've been in Buddhism for all these years. We've never done anything on time. It doesn't matter where you go or what country. I hear that in Japan they do things on time, but the rest of the Buddhist world, not really so much. And I'm thinking about that. Why is that? Why is it the Christians get stuff done on time and the Buddhists are always late?
We're not.
Aren't you?
When there's food, we're on time.
Ah, food. That's true, yeah. That's the only thing we get on time, yeah.
When there's shopping and when there's the money, we're on time.
Okay.
We're quite efficient when it comes to speed of making money here.
Uh-huh,
so we're really on time.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Okay. But when it comes to showing up for the meditation?
Well, we're still on time for some of us.
Some. And then I thought, well, I know what it must be. It must be to do with rebirth. Because in Christianity, you only get one shot. Right? So if you don't make it this lifetime, you're finished. Yeah? That's it. Whereas in Buddhism, oh, never mind. We've got another... yeah, another go next time. So...
So how do we practice a sense of urgency?
Practice a sense of urgency. Well, if I just come back to that the question you mentioned before about the procrastination and how we're practicing in our lives, I think. Yeah, in the talk I was mostly focusing on the meditation aspects, but I think we should. So there's a number of things I think that's useful from a practical point of view. One thing from a practical point of view is to recognize the fact that our lives are managed quite finely by time. In a way that's actually quite unusual and quite recent. Like we have clocks and we have watches, we have appointments and all of these kinds of things. And that's quite an unusual way to live. certainly in terms of human evolution, right? Now, if we look at village culture and things like that, until quite recently, time is much more vague. Yeah, it's in the morning time or it's in the afternoon and so on. So if we recognize that, I think it's a good thing to do, to step outside of that from time to time. Yeah, to give yourself that opportunity when you go on holidays or just have a weekend or something like that, to not have to fill everything up with appointments and meetings and things all the time. Yeah? And to just allow there to be some spontaneity, to not have to plan everything fully. And sometimes what you find is that if you do that, that things really work out much better for you. Yeah? So you give yourself that chance. I remember last year we had a little problem with the we were doing some Dhamma talks, and we used to video the Dhamma talks, and we had a video camera with a stand, and so the guy who was adjusting it pulled the lever the wrong way and broke the stand, so we had to get a new one. So we're like, okay, and then we looked it up on the web, where do you get them from, and you have to drive to the place, and you have to find parking, and then it's expensive, and can you get a cheaper one somewhere else, and blah blah blah, and can you get it on eBay, and we didn't make any decisions. Anyway, the next day we went to Dana at this restaurant, and we're walking back to the car, and we're walking through a part of Sydney which was in Newtown, in the back streets of Newtown. It's like an old working class district. It's very small little houses and very small, narrow laneways. And we're just walking down a random little laneway, and on one of these little houses, and it's just, you know, just like a front porch about as big as this stand where the Buddha is or something like that, there's a guy sitting on a chair having a bit of a garage sale, right? But not a proper garage sale, just like he's got a couple of chairs and a bicycle and a couple of bits and a video recorder stand, video camera stand. Honestly. And we're just walking randomly down this road, and there's a guy sitting on his front porch selling one of these things for like half the price you buy it in the shops, exactly the right size, and he showed us how he can adjust it so we're not going to break it again. So that's pretty good, isn't it? So I decided I'm going to live my entire life like that from now on. I'm just going to wander randomly around the place, and everything will work out fine. Yeah. So it's going good so far. Yeah. So I think if we recognize, of course we have to, you know, keep appointments and be on time and do all of those kinds of things, but don't let it take control of you. Make sure that you give yourself some break and some space which is free from that kind of thing. I think this is really important. Yeah. Okay, sense of urgency. Well, there's a word in Pali that they call sangvega, and sangvega is usually translated as a sense of urgency or something like that. And sangvega is like it's like what happens if you. It's sense of urgency is a kind of it's a very difficult term to translate into English, and literally it's the feeling that you get when something astonishing happens, like say if you see a ghost, right, then that would be sangvega. Yeah? Yeah, and there's a kind of sense of awe or being just excited or something like that. So in a Buddhist context, the sangvega means kind of you feel this intensity or this drive towards practicing the Dhamma and realizing the Dhamma, and it is an interesting thing because it has to be something which is in balance. So on one hand, if you become too complacent and too bored, then you won't put enough effort into your practicing. On the other hand, if you're pushing too much, then it's just an expression of restlessness. So that's something which you need to sort of see how it's balanced and how it's playing out in the particular context. One of the things which I've really noticed is that if you look at how the different teachers teach Dhamma, they always teach Dhamma in a way that's very suitable for that context. But then what happens is that the teachings are taken out of that context and they're read in a very different way from a different context. And, you know, one of the things that really strikes me is if you read the teachings of a lot of the forest Ajahns from Thailand, Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Mun and so on, and they're always talking about putting forth effort and, you know, really striving and making a lot of, you know, this kind of warrior energy, especially Ajahn Mahabua, right? He's got this really kind of warrior spirit. He used to be a kickboxer. It's true, Ajahn Mahabua was a kickboxer. So, but then the interesting thing for me, because I lived in those monasteries, right? So it's very different. If you pick up the book in the Buddhist center, I lived there for 6 years, right? So you're when you live in those monasteries, sabai, right? just relax, take it easy. Actually, the monasteries, the monks are very relaxed. The feeling of the monasteries is very friendly and so on and so forth. And you realize, well, actually, that's what the culture is like. Actually, the people are very friendly, they're very relaxed and so on. So that's why the teachers taught like that, right? Because the monks were lazy. Come on, get on with it. Do some meditation. Get on with it, right? Because that's what they needed at that time in that place, right? So this is why that they would be giving that teaching. Is that the same in Singapore? Not sure. I don't necessarily think so. So in Singapore, in fact, I think in most urban culture around the world, we tend to have the opposite problem, don't we? We're too driven, we're too ambitious, we're too restless, we're too much career. It's always looking to the future, always trying to get more, all of these things. And of course, what happens is when we come to spiritual practice, right? What happens is we suffer because of that. Our lives are out of balance. We're too much ambition, too much striving, too much getting things done. So we come to spiritual practice to let go of that suffering, but we bring the same attitudes to our spiritual practice. Yeah? And this is what I see all the time. Oh, now I've got to do more meditation, I've got to get this, I've got to get on that retreat, and I've got to do that. And this is what they call spiritual materialism. Right? Spiritual materialism. Right? You bring the same attitudes to your meditation that you have in those materialist lives. Yeah, oh, I'm going to achieve this, I'm going to get that, I'm going to find the best guru, I'm going to get the most enlightened, the best empowerment, all of these things. So it's spiritual materialism. So it's a brilliant phrase, isn't it? Yeah, it's really good. Really, once you hear that, sometimes phrases or words, when you hear it, oh, that's what really captures that idea really well. So So for us who are living in that modern urban environment, usually, yes, that sense of urgency needs to be there in terms of we need to keep that perspective in mind. We remember that we're still subject to birth, aging and death and all of these things. But the main emphasis we have to be is about that side of letting go of things. Yeah.
I just want to ask a very, I guess, basic question. You use the phrase, she's a deep meditator or she's a good meditator. When you say that, how do you deem that someone is a good or a deep meditator?
Well, what makes somebody a good meditator? Yes. Well, it's a bit hard to measure, really. So it's a bit relative. On the one hand, you can't really know these things too much, right? They're always changing. But when you've been teaching for a long time, and especially if you can talk to somebody at some length about their meditation, then you usually get some kind of sense for where people are at. It's very hard to understand what's going on in people's meditation. Because the way that we describe our minds is we can only use it by reference to external things. Right? That's what we can share. We have a shared perception of external things and then we apply those same words. So for example, we can say something's peaceful. And we know what peaceful means in an external sense, right? People aren't arguing with each other and so on, and that's peaceful. So what does that mean in the mind, right? Well, two people can say their minds were peaceful, but actually they're talking about completely different kinds of things. Yeah. So the For me, the best way of understanding that, if you can talk to somebody at some length about their meditation, first of all, you get a sense for, you know, just how they are, right? So you get a sort of intuitive sense for, you know, how together they are and how mindful they are and so on. You also get a sense for how clear that they are in understanding what's going on for them, right? And this is something which, again, can only emerge after a period of time. You know, whether somebody really knows what's happening. And the other thing which is very important is getting a sense for what is the flow of the meditation. You can tell a lot more from understanding the course of the meditation, how it proceeds over a period of time, than you can by somebody just saying, oh, my mind felt peaceful, or I got into second jhana, or I did this, or I did that. Yeah? When people say those kinds of things to me, it's basically meaningless. Okay? Until I know the context in which someone's practicing and what they actually mean by those words, and then I can get a sense for it. Yeah. Is that helpful? No. That's all right.
Do you want to add any comments?
No, I mean, I just recently came back from the Vipassana meditation.
Uh-huh.
So I just want to understand more about the process and how do I become better at it, I guess. Because when you know,
it's ihipasiko. It's ihipasiko. It is to be self-realized.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest thing at that time, if you just come back from a retreat and so on, is just keep your practice regular, and you will know over a period of time. Yeah, when you first begin, have you been practicing for long? Or
my retreat was in
Japan. So it was your first retreat? Yeah. So just keep going, and you keep reflecting, and over time you'll get a sense for where that's going and so on. Yeah, it takes a while. Especially what you usually find is the first few years when you're meditating, that things tend to be very up and down. And I've had those experiences. You go to one retreat and it's fantastic, and then you go to another retreat and everything's exactly the same, except that it's completely awful. Right? All the external conditions are identical, but but after a few years, anyway, that's what I found. After a few years, it kind of ups and downs like that, and things become much more even. Yeah.
I suppose in this part about how good and how progressive you are, no one can tell you, other than yourself. Whatever the teachers can teach us, it's all from theory. It's all from their own practice. The testimony of how well that you're a meditator comes about in terms of your own daily lives, your actions, your thoughts, and how you deal with the challenges of life. So we kind of want to be wary when people tell us that, you're progressing to this stage and that stage. But you should ask yourself the question, how peaceful am I? How happy am I? And how am I able to deal with the situations that I'm facing? And that will be perhaps, your own measurement, your own yardstick of how you've started, where you started from, and how much you progress. Because the Buddha in the suttas, if you read the suttas, have never described that as in telling someone that, you've achieved this jhana and that jhana. Am I right, Ajahn?
Pretty much, yeah. There's lots of suttas, so usually you can find an exception to something. But on the whole, that's right. Yeah, he would describe the meditation and encourage people to practice it. But he wasn't sort of going around sort of judging people all the time, and he was also quite critical of people who would do that. Yeah. Okay, any more questions? We should be wrapping up soon, but time for maybe one more question. Come on.
I have a really weird question. Excellent. You know, you talk about living in the present, right? But, I mean, the whole reason of you being a monk, or like the whole reason of us being here to practice, is in seek of a goal, probably in Nibbana, and some of us is just to be happier. And it's not really timeless in that sense, because there's a goal that we want to achieve, for sort of like a greater goal. So how do you actually balance energy? I mean, such that you don't get complacent in terms of your practice, like, oh, I'm just being present, and like, you know, it's a fine line between sloth and torpor, as well as being, you know, having the right energy to practice. So what's your advice on that? And yeah.
Look, I mean, it's just always shifting. So I don't think there's any hard and fast things. But I think sometimes if you are feeling a bit on that side of being lazy and unmotivated and so on, then sometimes to reflect about the future can be useful. Okay, so you can reflect. There's a bunch of suttas, for example, that are called the Anagata Bhayani Sutta. Is the reflections on the fears in the future. And so you reflect that, you know, in the future, at the moment I can practice meditation. In the future I don't know what's going to happen. Is global warming going to happen? Is the economy going to crash? Am I going to lose my job? Whatever. Is my health going to fail? So there could be all of these things that mean that I won't be able to practice in the future. And so then you bring that back into the present. So you can use these reflections as ways of giving yourself some energy and some inspiration to practice. But on the other hand, if your energy is already good, yeah, and you're already practicing well, then there's no need to do that. Yeah? So then you just leave it, and you just keep on practicing. Yeah. That wasn't weird at all, I don't think. I think it was quite a straightforward question. So you need to work on making your questions weirder. Okay.
I don't think any one of us can give you a very difficult question, Ajahn. You're too knowledgeable. I think we all agree that Bhante Sujato is a very knowledgeable monk, especially on the suttas. And that's also because that he's been very instrumental in putting together a whole archive, a whole library of the original and early Buddhism text, and one of which is through his channel on his blog. If you are not following Ajahn's blog, I think you should. It is sujato.wordpress. Okay, Sujato's blog. And Bhante Sujato is one of the teachers who's actually on Facebook. So find him. Not really. No. I receive.
Okay. I do have the supermedic update.
Okay.
Okay. Facebook.
No.
Facebook creepy.
Right.
So as you mentioned before, our sort of central project, I won't talk about. If I get started talking about it, I'll be here till tomorrow morning, and I need to get some sleep. So anyway, we've been working. Sutta Central is an ongoing project to bring together all of the early Buddhist texts from all the original languages and in the modern translations. I think it is mad and crazy that in Buddhism we don't have all of our sacred scriptures available for free for anybody to read them. And that we're the only major religion of which that's true. I think that's you know, just stop and think about that for a while. I think it's terrible. Why is it that people can't just get the suttas and read them if they want to? In any language, not just in it. We can't even do it in one language, right? The most comprehensive range of translations in any modern language is in Vietnamese, actually. That's a bit surprising, isn't it? Yeah, but they actually have a very wide range. That's still not complete, even in Vietnamese. English is probably number two, but there's no there's no modern language into which all of the early Buddhist texts have been translated. And so I'd like to try to change that. I'd like to try to bring it into modern languages. I've got a Bible app on my phone, and I can read the Bible in 500 languages if I want to. Right? Why can't I read the suttas in 500 languages? Well, because I can't speak 500 languages, but you know, you get the point, okay? Why? Right? People should be able to read the Dhamma. It doesn't matter where they come from, what language they come from. Yeah. And so I think this is really something which we should put some attention to, and which there's an opportunity for the first time ever using the tools of the internet and the digital technologies that have been developed in the last couple of decades. I think for the first time we can really bring the Dhamma to everybody in the world, wherever they're from, whatever language they speak.
It's a very interesting insight. On the way down from the airport, we had a conversation, and Bhante Sujato shared about the survey about the Americans.
Yeah, apparently 25% of Christians in America read the Bible every day.
Yeah? 25%, that's one quarter.
That's one quarter. And when they did their survey, all of these Christian websites were saying, this is terrible, why isn't it 100%?
Let's take a poll here. How many of us read the Sutta every day? Put up your hands. We've taken the Panchasila. I'm quite sure.
None?
Seriously? Okay, but bits and pieces of the Dhamma. How many of us read part of the Dhamma every day?
Something in Dhamma, not necessarily suttas, okay?
Yeah.
What about once a week? So it's interesting. So, you know, I think this is something. These things have conditions. It's not just random. There are conditions. There are cultural reasons and so on why this is the case. And so I don't want to. Again, that's why I said I could keep talking all night about these things. But I mean, I don't want to overstate the fact. I mean, I don't think everybody doesn't have to be a scholar, right? Everybody doesn't have to be you don't have to spend a lot of time with these kinds of things, right? But at least to have some interest and some knowledge of what it is that the Buddha taught. And actually, most of the suttas you find, the Buddha, apart from everything else, was, I believe, the world's first and best blogger. Yes. True. If you look at most of the suttas, like in Anguttara Nikaya, it's all these lists. Yeah? The four of this and the five of this. But isn't that one of the most common things you find on the internet today, isn't it? On blogs and stuff. It's like, you know, the five best movies or the five things and, yeah? The five best funny cat videos or something. And the Buddha was doing that 2,500 years ago. It's the same thing. It's like, how do you organize information in just a short way that's memorable and that makes sense? It's exactly the same thing that he's doing. So actually, you know, a lot of these suttas, they actually just present just a little bit, you know, enough ideas that you can get that. We can only takes a few minutes to read, and then it gets you a little bit of Dhamma. So again, these are some things that I'm thinking about to try to think. Well, how do we bring it across in a way that's really useful and relevant?
On this trip, in support of Ajahn's endeavors with the Sutta Central, there is a separate box actually near the door for donations to Sutta Central. So there is a team of people who maintains and manages this particular library. And yeah, that's the box over there. Okay. If we may call it a night. Yeah. We'll have to call it a night now because Ajahn had a very long day, and he's going to be conducting a retreat tomorrow, a full day retreat tomorrow. I'm quite sure we're all very appreciative and very grateful for his teaching tonight. Perhaps if we could ask everybody to be in Anjali, and we pay three respects to Bhante Sujato so that he could take his leave and his rest. All right? Okay.